Right now, free speech is under heavy attack in New Zealand and overseas, with governments constantly devising new ways to enforce censorship. To make sure you never miss the critical news and breaking stories you rely on, join the RCR mailing list today. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.
Welcome back to the weekly roundup on the dialogue with Dewa De Boer and William McGimsey for Reality Check Radio. And here we take a look back on the week, the key political events, both at home and overseas from the past week. Welcome back to the show, William.
Thanks, Dewa. It's good to join you again.
And I know that you have been listening in to the interview that I just did with Gareth, and he brought up a report from the Privacy Commissioner into basically what police could do monitoring social media. I had a bit of a quick scan over that in the break just to refresh my memory. And the whole situation with Gareth, by the way, if people are listening to this on replay or they've just tuned in, basically he had the police turn up at his door and say they wanted to talk about some stuff that he had said online, posted on the internet anonymously, and he hadn't committed any crimes. They just wanted to have a little chat with him. And you know, he said, "You're investigating thought crimes." And they said, "Yep, yeah, basically that's what we're doing." And they ended up suspending his license because he didn't want to talk to them about things he had posted. And they said, "We have interpreted what you've said, and we've decided that it's violent or whatever. We've decided you have some kind of violent intent, and we're taking your firearms, suspending your firearms license." And I definitely would recommend going back and listening to that interview if you missed it. But what do you think about what he said then, that the police are running these investigations behind the scenes? So they have police who have their own little internal department where they quote unquote volunteer to go and scour the internet and find things that anonymous accounts or maybe real people, you know, people who are putting their names and their faces to what they're saying and looking at it and saying, "Ooh, this person said something hateful. This is a non-crime hate incident." And they then go and log that against the person in the police database, or they try and identify. They use various open source intelligence methods to find out who is running the anonymous account. And then the police go and give them a knock on the door at 5, 6 p.m. in the evening.
Well, it's institutionalized political discrimination, and it's spot government surveillance of people on the basis of their political views. So this is the trick that Jacinda Ardern pulled, and many other people have tried to pull as well. They're saying, if you have certain political views, we're just going to conflate that with violent extremism and then get the security intelligence people or the police or whoever it is to monitor you. And in this case, go around and threaten to take your firearms license away or actually take it away just for posting memes or posting opinions we don't like on the internet. The thing is, the views that they're characterizing as violent extremism are not violent or not necessarily violent at all. In order for something to be violent, you actually have to commit violence or be inciting other people to commit violence. You can't just have a view such as, for example, we should have less immigration, or we should have less immigration of a certain type of people. For example, we should have less immigration of Muslim people because they don't integrate well and that they're committing too many crimes when they get here, or something like that. There's many examples of these types of beliefs you can have. Now, a lot of people will disagree with that view, but there's nothing inherently violent about the view. And you could just as easily conflate certain left-wing views with violence. There's a lot of Antifa people running around who commit violence. You could say people who are promoting equality, that's a necessarily violent view. And we look at all these examples we have of the Antifa people running around. We're going to spy on all the people who think equality is a good idea and go around and threaten to take their firearms licenses away or do whatever else. It's political discrimination, institutionalized political discrimination, what they're doing. And they're not saying he's doing something illegal, but they are doing something that effectively punishes and disincentivizes him and others from expressing those views online. So it's a threat to people's freedom of speech, and it disincentivizes certain views from being expressed. So I think this is completely unacceptable from the government, and there needs to be a stop put to it. And David Seymour, you know, he's out there talking about equal rights. Well, if he wants equal rights, why doesn't he do something about this?
Absolutely the case. And that was a point I raised earlier with Gareth, and that, you know, it's all fine for him to stand up and say we have freedom of speech. But if people like Gareth are saying, have to say, well, look, I can't actually say what I think online anymore because the police are harassing me and it's damaging my family and, you know, I might lose my firearms license and so on. I can't say what I think online because of police harassment. Well, then you don't have freedom of speech. You can say, oh, yes, we have all the laws to, you know, have freedom of speech. If people are unable to say what they really think, then you just don't have freedom of speech in practice. And that's far more important than some kind of legal argument and say, well, the laws are fine. That's clearly in practice, things are very, very wrong. And you pointed out the left-wing dissenters and so on. The privacy report that Gareth referred to actually mentions those left-wing views by name. It talks about marginalized groups, Maori activists, LGBTQ plus activists and so on, saying they might be at risk of surveillance by police that would impact their privacy negatively. Of course, again, the Privacy Commissioner really should be saying, hey, conservative people are at risk of being tracked by the police and being afraid to speak their mind because they're being harassed by the police. That's what's actually happening now. And of course, they mention Muslims as well, Muslims being concerned about being surveilled and so on by police. This is being used by the police now against their political opponents. And it's only getting worse because they can use AI tools, perfectly fine for them to use artificial intelligence to collect large amounts of data and process it. They're allowed to use undercover social media accounts as well. I may just quickly read this from the report that I've got in front of me. They say that a public servant could choose an online persona that has a different race, gender, or age from their real identity, and they could set up multiple personas given time and technological capacity. They could then use those personas to interact with other people. And
the Fed posting manifesto. This itself could be characterized as violent extremism. If it was the right wing people who weren't in the government doing it, those would be the type of memes the police would be coming to visit you for, and that they're providing a manual on how to do it if you're inside the government.
Yeah, and this is just the like the short summary of the report, by the way. The full report, I pulled it up in the break and had like 60 something pages. I can't look at the whole thing, but just completely crazy that this is legal in New Zealand and the police are doing it. And they're doing it in this case with clear political motivations, because whenever they talk about these quote unquote hate incidents, and we may as well bring up some of the other subject incidents throughout the world in the past week, because the UK have ramped up their non-hate incident visits as well. It's much worse in the UK, by the way, but this is what Jacinda Ardern wanted for New Zealand. This is what the New Zealand police want for themselves. They're paying people visits not because of firearms license, you know, related things, just like kids at school. There was one this week where they found out they had 12-year-old kids who had these non-hate crime incidents logged against their names in police databases in the UK because they had said something like racist to other kids at school.
Yeah, that's ridiculous. I mean, does anyone really want to live in a society like that? I don't think anyone would really want to live in a society like that if it was these things being done to them. And so, I mean, I would just ask people to just think about that. And even if you're not one of these conservative people or people on the right or people with a firearm or anyone like that, if this stuff was being done to you, would you object to it? And we know the answer because there's been Green MPs in the past, like Keith Locke, who has been spied on and had things like this done to him and who has objected to it. So no one likes this being done to them, but everyone likes doing it to the other guy. So why don't we just come to an agreement that we don't want this stuff in our society?
And hopefully this is something that the Free Speech Union will pick up a little bit more. I mean, I know the Free Speech Union are well aware of what's going on here, and hopefully there's some action here in terms of getting, as you mentioned, some kind of consensus amongst parties, at least the governing parties, perhaps, to have some proper reform of the police in this area, and you know, something that's actually put forward as an election promise that we can get in one of these coalition agreements and get that fixed up. I think that's very, very important to think about as we roll through this political term.
But Jonathan Ayling is claiming victory on this. He's saying that and this might have happened while you're in Japan, I'm not sure. He's claiming victory in that they've talked to the police. They've got concessions from the police commissioner in terms of reviewing the hate training and reviewing the way they're logging these hate incidents. However, that What they actually said in that release is that they're still going to go after hate incidents based on people saying things about the protected categories, which are in the human rights legislation. So race, sex, sexuality, which is basically, it's conservative people who make arguments about those things. So it's still going after one side of the political spectrum. And the way they've changed it is, they say, rather than, you know, perceptions based on harm, it has to be linked to a reasonable threat of physical violence. So the comment has to include what someone perceives as a policeman perceives as a reasonable threat of physical violence. But the problem with that is they are claiming that right-wing people are violent extremists anyway. So these people have no problem with just claiming there's a threat of violence, even when there's not. So it just seems like we're back to square one here. We haven't made any progress at all.
And I mean, the Free Speech Union's legal team is aware of this. And I think hopefully this is a PR issue and definitely something that, you know, we should bring up with Jonathan Ayling next time we speak with him. But he needs to be well aware that it's in the documents here that Gareth has provided, that the police straight up say, we believe that this will lead to violence and so on. They've actually done this to people on the other side as well. People remember the case of Rachel Stewart, who was a radical feminist. And she had the same thing. We had the police said, she made some joke about doing something violent to someone in a joking context. And the police said, you have threatened violence against someone. We are now coming after you. When obviously a normal person, because these police officers are clearly not normal people, and a normal person would look at that and say, that's a joke. That's satire. That's in context, not violent.
They strategically pretend not to understand humor.
Yes, correct. Exactly. So they're police officers, clearly. Anyone employed by the police can't be categorized as a normal person. They're clearly not. We have ample evidence. We can get a panel. We could put it in front of a panel of normal people, and we could call them a jury. Anyway, but they just need to get rid of this. I won't even make a joke about it. The police cannot be trusted with this. Very, very clear.
Yeah, I agree.
And let's just get straight into the big local issue of the week from here. I know we normally do international issues, but we talked a lot about Trump last week. So let's go and talk about the issue we didn't really talk about last week. And that was the Treaty Principles Bill, which had been introduced and is now actually being read to Parliament and has led to various protests and antics. And what is the gist of this to you? What is going on with the Treaty Principles Bill?
There's a lot that could be said here. So basically what happened is that they had the first reading of the bill. So the bill gets introduced to Parliament and they have a vote on whether they're going to introduce it and send it to the select committee or whatever they do straight away to start working on it. And, you know, they have the numbers to do that, the numbers to get the vote through. But what they do is they have a series of speeches. So David Seymour gives his first speech introducing the bill and then people respond. Willie Jackson gave a speech immediately in response, started it off with saying, shame, shame, shame on you, David Seymour. And then there was a big litany of things he said. And then at the end, he called David Seymour a liar as he was sitting down. And that's against the rules of the House. You're not allowed to insult people or call them liars in the House. And this is something that comes up quite a lot because people call each other liars quite a lot in the House. Everyone knows you're not allowed to do it, and he did it anyway. And he was asked to apologise by the Speaker, as is the normal thing, and he refused, and so he got sent out of the House. And then there were several other speeches, and then it came time for the vote at the end, and everyone stands up and they say what party they're from and how many votes they've got to contribute. And when it came to the time for the Maori Party person to stand up and do that, it was Hana Rafferty Maipi Clark, I think is her name, the young Maori Party woman. Rather than say how many votes the Maori Party had to contribute to the tally against, she started doing a haka. And then Rory Waititi and other Maori Party people joined in. And so the Speaker stood up and he said, I'm suspending the House for half an hour. Get everyone out of the gallery. We'll start back in half an hour when the bells ring again. Obviously, he was upset and frustrated with what was going on. But when they came back in, he said, well, look, I'm going to suspend Hana Rafferty Maipi Clark from the House and name her. And naming is like the biggest sanction you can get as an MP. I'm not really sure what actually happens to you. I think you can get doctor day's pay or something. So it doesn't really seem that serious, but people say it's serious. And then they had the vote anyway, and the thing passed. But What it really was is a huge publicity stunt, because the clips of them doing the haka on the House floor have travelled all around the world, and it's huge publicity. But who does this publicity really help? And I think it probably helps David Seymour, and it helps the proponents of the Treaty Principles Bill, because people see that behaviour and they don't like it. But it may also help the Maori Party as well, because I think there'd be a lot of, there could be, and I don't know about this, but there could be a lot of people who would support the Maori Party and doing the haka to protest the bill. It's obviously an issue that at least a portion of Maori Dim are exercised about. They care about the treaty and they want to, they don't want to see the understood meaning that the courts have worked out be changed.
It would be good to focus a bit more on the publicity stunt side of things, because people often ask questions about this. I posted on X a few times and I got questions from people around saying, who does this benefit? Or, hey, why does David Seymour not do X, Y, and Z, or move on? They both clipped basically the same bit of the recording from Parliament. Both the ACT Party and the Maori Party both clipped the exact same clip, exact same event, and both put it on their social media accounts. One is positive, one is negative. So you sort of got, in a sense, they're two different audiences and two different echo chambers almost. But the question is, who's got the bigger impact here? Who are you targeting in terms of voters? And for the Maori Party, it is great for them because it benefits their own supporters. And they can speak to an international audience who are very much supportive of what they're doing. It's, as we would say, they sort of internationalize all of these issues. Same thing, how they tie their issues to Gaza and Palestinians and so on, indigenous causes. And that works very well for them. But it doesn't work well for their allies, right? It doesn't work well for the Green Party. It doesn't work well for the Labour Party, because you've got a lot of middle, ordinary people who look at this and quite disgusted by it. Even people who are opposed to the bill look at what the Maori Party is doing and say, oh, that's incredibly disrespectful and rude, and this is not how we expect serious people to conduct themselves. And then you've got people thinking, oh, if we vote for the Labour Party and the Green Party and so on, we're going to get the crazies in as well. And that's what the government might look like. So this is very beneficial generally to the right, in my opinion, because of that, because there's a lot of ammunition there to say, hey, and they did this last time, you vote for the Labour Party, you're going to get hipuapua, you're going to get separatism, you're going to get all kinds of race-based rights. And the ACT Party can play that card, but it benefits National, it benefits New Zealand First as well in that sense. So that's where I think the split really is. And there's no need for the ACT Party to capitalize on it any further by saying, like, oh, we need to get rid of the Maori seats and so on. That's not an issue that's brought up at the moment. Why? Because they've got this really hot issue that's has overwhelming support, right? If the Treaty Principles Bill went to a referendum, it would pass. Basically, everybody knows that. The opposition expects it as well. It's why they're throwing such a fuss about it. It's why the National Party won't support it. In fact, one of them, I think it was Goldsmith, said in an interview recently, say basically, yeah, we don't want this because if it would pass, and we actually don't want it, because it would get rid of however many years of treaty history, you know, since 1975. I'm going to do some quick maths here on the air, but I think it's about 50, close to 50 years, somewhere between 25, 30. I think they started about 35 years ago, because I think he said 35 years. And they've built up all of this legal, you know, the judges have made up an entire complicated bits of pseudo law around what the principles might mean and so on. And they make a lot of money off of this and a lot of judgments. They can squeeze a lot of sort of leeway in for treaty principles and so on. They love it. The judges absolutely love it. And this bill would just bury that. And one of the big reasons why the National Party doesn't want it.
Well, I agree with your analysis that generally it helps the right. So I think these hijinks help the right. They hurt the Labour Party, so they make the left bloc smaller, but they may help the Maori Party.
And that's exactly the way that I would put it as well. Good for the Maori Party, bad for the Labour Party.
Yeah. What's interesting about this is they've agreed National and New Zealand First are not going to vote for the Treaty Principles Bill. So in a way, this is sort of a moot point. We're Monday's moot points. So
And there is another interesting issue there, because, of course, well, the bill's going to fail anyway. So if you're the Maori Party, it's basically a guaranteed win, because you're going to defeat the bill. But they've created this big issue out of the fact that it's been introduced, saying even introducing it, even allowing this to be discussed is terrible and horrible, isn't a threat to our existence. When they could have played it for an easy win, basically say, well, let it be debated, let it come up, we'll oppose it. And then when it gets voted down, we can say, well, Parliament has spoken. You know, we debated the bill, we discussed the bill, people got a say on it, and we decided to get rid of it. But none of all of that is moot now, because it's just become a circus.
Well, I think the point that David Seymour makes, rightly so, is that for a long time we've had judges, lawyers, the Waitangi Tribunal, public servants beavering away, expanding the definition of what the plain text of the treaty says, to have these treaty principles, and they mean all these things that they've had to read in extremely far to and extrapolate out the meaning of the treaty in all these sort of fanciful ways. So he wants to give ordinary Kiwis the opportunity to have a say, to discuss it. And that's what we're going to get, right? We're going to get a public discussion about it, even if it goes nowhere. And that's probably a healthy thing. The public should get a chance to discuss these things, because they're basically quasi-constitutional. It serves a quasi-constitutional role in New Zealand's system. The treaty is a historic document, but because it's debated all the time, it's being put into legislation. The Labour Party greatly expanded this and used it as the basis for co-governance and all these other policies. So the fact that it's there and this interpretation has been developed, it's having a huge impact on our politics. So
there's one odd party out here, because New Zealand First is say that they are going to vote against it. But their base, as far as I can tell, is very much in favor of this. And the argument that New Zealand First makes to say, well, there shouldn't be any treaty principles, it doesn't fully hold up unless you're planning on like repealing the entire Waitangi Treaty Act from 1975, which is not really on the cards either. Are they going to play into this by supporting, say, a second reading, knowing that it's going to fail? Or are they going to stay on their current trajectory and say, no, we're voting against the treaty principles? And that potentially could hurt them at the next election, I would think. This is something that really could benefit the ACT Party if nobody else is willing to step up and also support it. Because then it becomes an issue that David Seymour can take to the electorate and say, I'm the only one. Right? You have to vote for me because I'm the only one that will bring it back in 2020. When's the next election for that? 2026, I think. 2027.
Yeah, well, I think that's the electoral calculation that ACT is making. But just on the principle of the matter, I'm with New Zealand First and National on this one. So New Zealand First has this other policy of deleting the treaty principles from legislation, which all the other parties have agreed to and which they're in the process of doing. So they've identified the pieces of legislation that have references to the treaty principles in, and they're either going to delete them or clarify exactly what they mean with references to the treaty. And so what the treaty principles bill does over and above that, I mean, I'm not sure. David Seymour makes the argument that, well, when Labour gets back in the next time, you know, they can just sort of put all those references back in, which I guess is true, but when Labour gets in back next time, they can introduce the anti-treaty principles bill and do the whole process in reverse as well. I guess the what David Seymour is claiming, we're going to have a constitutional discussion, the public's going to vote on it in a referendum. So it's not exactly the same thing, but still in principle, everything that's been done so far could be reversed. But the treaty is a written document. And although I think that the thing that the legal profession and the Waitangi Tribunal and public servants have done is kind of fraudulent and extrapolating it the way they have, I don't think having a public referendum on the meaning of the treaty is appropriate either. I view this as analogous to the debate in the US around the constitutional debate around the Supreme Court, where you've got the originalists, who are the lawyers and judges who believe you should interpret the Constitution according to the original meaning that the founders had, versus the progressive judges who think the Constitution is a living document and you should just interpret it however you like.
Basically. However it's relevant to the current people.
Yeah. However, in order to get the decision or law that you need.
You've already determined what it means. You just need to come up with pages and pages of legal jargon to shoehorn it in.
Yeah, so the judges and lawyers and the academics in the Waitangi Tribunal, they would basically be the equivalent of the progressive judges in the US who have sort of expanded the meaning of this document well beyond what was written there. And I think what David Seymour's written down in terms of his principles and his treaty principles bill That seems like a reasonably close approximation to what the treaty actually says when I read it. Everyone can go and read the actual treaty, the English version, and it's, I think it's relatively clear.
I agree with you 100% on that. It does a good job of that. The only criticism I would give of it is when you look at it in the historical context, sort of what the treaty actually did, I think it's actually too generous almost, the Treaty Principles Bill. Because if you look at, you think like, did they really intend to give equal rights to everybody? Because that's not really what they did in like the decades. I mean, if you look at history and you look at what happened in the decades after, like, well, it's clearly not what, you know, at least the government and the governors, the British administration, that's not really the view that they had, because they didn't treat everybody in that way. But maybe you could argue, well, the liberal, and I have written about this, well, the liberal, they kind of had liberal ideals, liberal idealists, and they knew they couldn't get everything they wanted in there, but they sort of set in motion the system of equality that we sort of ended up with anyway. And so I think David Seymour is right to say that is basically what they intended and basically what it should mean today. And those things, to me, they map up quite well.
Yes, I mean, I think that's right. However, just because that's what it means, it doesn't mean that I would necessarily support that. I think this is really I think what's going on in the background here is that this is a sort of the beginning of like a constitutional discussion. So if you think of what happened with the COVID-19 protests, a lot of people's rights were violated in terms of mandates, lockdowns, all these other things that the government put in place that violated people's basic rights. And out of that came this idea that we should embed the Bill of Rights somehow, that it should be embedded, be made some sort of, I'm not sure exactly what the terminology is, but some sort of primary piece of law that's very important.
Entrenched, basically, is often that can be used, yeah.
I mean, I think there's a lot to be said for that. And now we're talking about the treaty, and we're talking about the philosophical divide here is between David Seymour, who's got this, what he's for is a modern, liberal, multi-ethnic democracy, or that I've probably got the words.
That's roughly what he says about it, yeah.
Where everyone has equal rights and there's no, you don't make any distinctions based on race or anything like that. And so that's one sort of vision of what New Zealand could be. And then you've got this other vision where Maori and the Crown, the British Crown, are in a partnership, and the treaty was a historical document between two peoples that brought them together and founded a nation. And everyone on the right is, I feel like everyone on the right is being shepherded into supporting the modern liberal multi-ethnic democracy version. But I don't think that that's actually the real right-wing option here. I think that the answer is in the middle somewhere, and that the idea of New Zealand having a historical identity and a historical basis is more on the side of the other understanding of the treaty as a partnership between the British Crown and Maori. My big fear here is that we end up with some agreement where everyone on the right shepherded into supporting the modern liberal multi-ethnic democracy, and then mass immigration carries on because we're not allowed to talk about race, and the cultural Marxism carries on, and so we just end up with a completely subverted woke third world country where the traditional New Zealand identity, culture, and everything is a thing of the past and has been wiped away just by the big demographic changes. I don't want that. And so because of that, if we're going to be talking about constitutional arrangements, I think we need to put something in there to protect what New Zealand is, the New Zealand we know and love, which is a partnership between British settlers and Maori. And that's the New Zealand identity, and the institutions sprung up based on British institutions.
Well, thank you. Thank you for taking the conversation in the direction that I wanted it to go, because I commented online about the hikoi in particular, the protests that Maori in particular are having against the Treaty Principles Bill. I said, I don't really care very much about them, and I find it very hard to care about them because the actual cause that they're pushing for is essentially an ethno-nationalist cause, right? They want recognition of their race as people with special rights in a particular land. And saying, well, this is where, you know, we are the people, we are people who live in this land, and we have a stake in it as an ethnic group, and we want to make sure that's recognized. We're an ethnic minority. We want to be able, you know, we don't want to be outvoted by democracy, right? Mob rule, they can override us every time, right? They get the democracy is the two wolves and the sheep one sheep voting what to have for dinner. The wolves are always going to either go and eat the lamb. And that's sort of the view that they have. But they can't say it. They're not allowed to say it. Because the left wing prohibits any discussion, as you said, of race and nationalism in this way. So it's kind of uninteresting to me because you have no intellectuals who are able to make arguments on their side because they're not allowed to. They're not allowed to really follow through their own arguments to the logical conclusions.
I thought your comment on social media was interesting because it's almost like a sort of mirror image of the US debate, where worship of the Constitution is really like a proxy for a white identity politics in the United States. And here it's the other way around, you know, like worship of the treaty, another document.
Yeah, they can say, well, the treaty, this piece of paper gives us rights. We get special rights because the piece of paper says we have the rights. Like, I'm sorry, that's what conservatives in the US have been saying for a century. It's what we've been saying, like, you can, during COVID, right? Oh, the Bill of Rights. Well, guess what? You know, power is upstream from your rights. And at the end of the day, having that political power is what allows you to implement that. But if you want to use that political power, you need to be able to make an intellectual argument as to what you're doing with it and why you're doing it. And they're basically incapable. They're incapable of doing it because they're not allowed to talk about what they actually want, which is ethnic nationalism.
Another feature of this debate that I don't like is it feels almost as if the idea of equal rights is being pitted against the idea of self-determination of a people, or the idea of nationalism, or the idea that you can have a national identity defined in sort of ethnic, religious, cultural terms, that those two things are opposed. But they're not opposed in any logical sense. I just feel like that the idea of equal rights is being wielded like a cudgel here to say, well, I mean, you're an evil racist if you want that. But I think this is it's right and just for all peoples to have the right of self-determination. And that is one of the equal rights that all people should have. And that right is sort of being discarded here. And the implication, or what seems to be being argued, though not overtly, is that if you want a self-determination for your people, then you're against equal rights and you're a racist. And that is not necessarily logically true.
And something that David Seymour said was that his criticism of the Maori Party is saying, oh, well, they basically accusing them of this, saying, oh, they're making ethnic arguments. You know, they're saying that they view themselves as their own ethnic group and not as New Zealanders. And really, we're all New Zealanders. And I'm thinking, hang on, there's some this massive hypocrisy here from the ACT Party because they have an ethnic spokesperson, Paramjit Pamar, I believe, or Dr. Paramjit Pamar. She's the ethnic spokeswoman for the ACT Party. And the ACT Party go and like play dress up for Chinese New Year, and they go to the Indian festivals in Diwali, and they have all of this ethnic targeted political electioneering and stuff that they do. So very much like when it comes to real politic, the ACT Party recognizes the distinct ethnic groups, and they pander to different ethnic groups when they need to do it. And then suddenly when it's the Maori Party, oh, then it's wrong. This is obviously is completely incoherent.
David Seymour was completely hypocritical on this point. Up to 5 minutes ago, he was for identity politics. He was even for the transgender identity politics. He was for all the trans stuff until Winston Peters started eating into his electoral support in the election, and then he changed his mind. But even if we go back further than that, David Seymour was for all sorts of different identity politics. He supports women's rights. He supports gay rights. He supports anti-discrimination against all sorts of ethnic minorities. He's for all sorts of identity politics, just not these ones. And so that's the real hypocrisy. You have to be consistent about these things. It's no use turning against identity politics now. If you're against identity politics, you have to be against all of the developments since the 1960s countercultural movements, which were all based on identity politics. All those civil rights movements are based on identity politics, whether it's African Americans, gays, whether it's women, whether it's transgender people. It's an identity group organizing around its identity to lobby for its rights. And you can't be against that now just because a group that you don't like is doing it, just because Maori are doing it, or just because white people might want to do it. This is totally logically inconsistent, incoherent, and hypocritical. You've got to have it one way or the other.
And this ties into another problem, basically, something that David Seymour supports, something that the other side, the Maori Party, the Green Party Act, the Labour parties won't really talk about, and that's that the immigration, mass migration, the Great Replacement has to a large degree made Maori ethnic nationalist aspirations almost impossible. And it's something that fuels David Seymour's arguments for the Treaty Principles Bill is, but we're a multi-ethnic country, right? We have Indians, the third largest ethnic group in the last, I'll get you to go through the immigration numbers in a minute. The Chinese people, Filipino people, so on, not very far behind. And you've got all of these different ethnic groups that have been brought into New Zealand in, through mass migration and through the replacement of New Zealand's historic ethnic groups you talked about earlier, particularly the British, English, European settlers and the Maori, the Polynesians. And that's really made what the Maori Party want, I would say, impossible to a large degree. What do these immigration numbers look like for the last few months? I know that we've got an update on this, the Great Replacement updates that we've been doing, one a month, and we have the September figures. Could you give us a little overview of those and how they're going to be impacting political issues in New Zealand going forward?
So the number of people who came in to the year to September 2024 was about 177,000. The number of migrant departures is about 133,000, which is a record. So the net of people who came in minus the people who left was about 46,000, I believe. So still very high numbers of people coming in, though it's coming down somewhat. It was up above 200,000, was at the peak at about 250,000. So it's there's been a significant fall off there, but it's still historically high. The number of people leaving now is at record levels, both in terms of overall departures, and we're setting records as well for departures of New Zealand citizens, which are at about 54,000. So it's a significant brain drain, and while large numbers of people are still coming in. However, we also learned today there's a report out by the Auditor General that says that something unbelievably low, only 1.38%, I think.
No, that's right. I rounded it to 1.4, which is easier for people to remember, perhaps. 1.4% of immigrants are what?
That's skilled immigrants, only 1.4%. So 98%, over 98% of the immigrants coming in are unskilled immigrants.
That's mind-bogglingly insane. 98.6% of immigrants are unskilled immigrants. Visas are being given to unskilled immigrants. 98.6% unskilled immigration. This is the most insane figure that I've heard of all of these figures. I'm looking at the raw numbers. I'm seeing a wave, kind of a downward wave a little bit for the incoming. And I'm seeing a massive upward wave on the outgoing. And, you can't see that on the radio. I can't show it to you. But just to hear that number of 98.6% of incoming immigrants and visas being given to people coming to this country for unskilled jobs.
It's hard to believe you could get that by chance. It's almost as if they're stopping the skilled people coming in and they're deliberately getting the unskilled ones. You would almost have to be doing something like that to get that many unskilled people coming in. So this is an outrage. The arguments for immigration on an economic sense, like, over the past decades, we've got extremely fraudulent arguments about the economic benefits of immigration that have been fed to us. If there are economic benefits to immigration, they come from having skilled workers, moderate numbers of skilled workers. But we're not getting that. We're getting low numbers of skilled workers and large numbers of unskilled workers that are coming in. They're overwhelming our housing and infrastructure and basic services. And the amount of that their earning capacity and the value capacity they're providing to the economy is low. So that is going to drive our GDP per capita and our average wages and all that stuff down through the floor.
And perhaps this explains somewhat why we have been seeing a GDP per capita recession, because we've been talking about this, I think, for 2 years in a row now. We've had a GDP per capita recession. It's starting to make sense a little bit because we have insane levels of government spending, which tend to drive up GDP, and yet there's still this massive reduction in what the actual sort of wealth generation per person is looking like in New Zealand. And yeah, I'm still struggling to process those numbers. There will need to be some more develop there, and somebody needs to go and ask the immigration minister. I know I'm talking here as an RCR host, but we'll sort that out. Someone, we'll get that sorted. Someone on RCR is going to ask somebody from the government what is going on here, and we're going to get an answer from them.
That is not doing your job if you're an immigration minister. And some of this stuff happened before Erica Stanford came in, I believe. But if you can't get that under control, you should be fired.
Oh, certainly. And it will be very, very interesting to see how this story develops. And unfortunately, we can't answer any further than that. But there have to be answers to these numbers, because that is just completely insane. I think on the rest of the immigration side, not much has changed in the reports that we have been doing. Basically, it's the same countries of origin, same country that most New Zealanders are leaving to as well. People are going to Australia. Mostly, again, it's India, China, the Philippines, and so on, where immigrants are coming from. It has made basically no changes to this, other than making small reductions in the numbers so far.
Yep, Australia's the destination of choice. I mean, the overall trend is, although the numbers leaving is a bad trend, the trend coming down is a good trend. So I am hopeful that over time, eventually, we'll get the numbers right.
Now, this is, I guess, if we stay on the topic of immigration, has been a big issue in the European Union. And there have been a few developments there with the German government, which has basically collapsed, and they have put up a date for their elections in February. Now, I've got someone from Germany to interview, hopefully in the next few weeks, just setting that up, but it should happen. And I think we'll get some good insights from them. But there have been renewed calls as well there to ban the AfD, the Alternative for Deutschland. And, you know, with their elections coming up, what's the number one issue? It's basically immigration. The AfD is polling at 20%. Do you see some positive outcomes from that election, or you think they're going to end up like Austria has, where they basically have a hung parliament? Like, their immigration has become such a big issue, but it's still a very highly polarized issue, and that the mainstream, the legacy parties, if we can call them that, are blocking any attempt to actually seriously reform the system, and willing to shut the government down, basically make it impossible to form stable governments because of the immigration issue.
Yeah, well, I mean, the pattern I see developing is the right-wing populist parties, the right-wing anti-immigration parties doing well. The other parties are ganging up to try and shut them out of power. Those sort of things are breaking down, and the public's punishing them. And then the public is voting for even more of the right-wing anti-immigration populist parties. So I would imagine the pattern would go something like that, that these mainstream parties who have failed and their government has fallen apart, they will be punished and they will leech support to the AfD. That's what I think will probably happen.
And elsewhere in Europe, in France, lawfare basically being used against Marianne Le Pen. It's been threatened now that she'll be banned from participating in the next presidential election. There's a theme here with these things, threatening to ban a political party. It's like, oh, the political party is too popular. What if we threaten to ban them? I'm sure that's going to help. She's doing well in the polls, but she's really struggled to win a presidential election, to win an outright majority. Very, very difficult. Do you have any particular insight into, you know, whether or not Marianne Le Pen is going to be able to run, going to be able to win, or do you see another generation stepping up, before the French sort themselves out?
Well, I would hope that she could run again. The charges she's facing would preclude her, I think, from running in the next election. So she's facing a big fines, potentially jail time, and an inability to run. So,
for context, the thing she's accused of is like misusing funds from European Union election, something along those lines. That
seems some sort of embezzlement or something. It seems like a jack-up, basically.
Yes, that's absolutely what it seems like. So we'll keep you updated on how that develops as well. Speaking of lawfare as well, we've got one more issue in the United States to go into there. Alex Jones basically has been shut down, or InfoWars has been bought out. And it's very hard to tell at the moment still what's going on there. I was going to ask you about this with the situation with The Onion and so on, but they seem to have initiated another round of accusations that the auction that was supposed to sell off the InfoWars assets and so on was not properly conducted, and Alex Jones is giving it another go. But it seems like the whole situation in the end wasn't really about money, about getting, because, you know, they fined him billions of dollars. It seems like the families who sued him there weren't really interested in the most amount of money. They just wanted to destroy InfoWars, destroy Alex Jones, which seems like, to me, very much like the wrong strategy, because, you know, Alex Jones is a brand, as a personality. They can't really destroy him. It's a very unfortunate situation, in my opinion.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they're trying to shut him down. I mean, Alex Jones has, he's an interesting character, isn't he? He has a lot of strange opinions. He has a lot of kooky opinions, a lot of conspiracy opinions.
Infotainment is what I've always viewed it as.
But there's a lot of genuine insight, and he's onto a lot of genuine problems that have been shut out from mainstream media as well. You can learn things by listening to Alex Jones. I've learned things from listening to Alex Jones. He's interesting, and he's fun. Like, it's fun to listen to him. He makes it fun to listen to. You're part of something. You're part of an information war. So I enjoy it, and I enjoy when he goes on other podcasts like Joe Rogan and he talks about stuff. He's got a fun style of speaking. People think it's kooky or whatever, and that sort of brings what he's saying into disrepute. But he's an interesting character, with a mix of a genuine insight and also some funny stuff. He's being treated unfairly. But, I mean, there's a pattern here, as we're seeing, where you get treated unfairly, it brings attention to you, you become kind of a martyr, and it sort of helps you in a way. So that seems to be what happened to Trump. It seems to be happening to other figures. The unfairness actually can end up helping you in the end. Although, losing your business and losing a lot of money, that's a serious blow to take.
But there's a big pattern here across the world where it seems like the use of lawfare has kind of become the primary means of trying to shut up or shut down rising right-wing, or successful right-wing political parties or information networks. And in Donald Trump's case, presidents and presidential candidate. Now, we did talk too much about Trump last week, and I've sort of left him to the end here, but we do have a couple of minutes just to speak very briefly about Trump's picks. A number of cabinet positions have been announced, and I mean, many people may have heard of those, but we could quickly go through a few highlights from last week. I think probably the number one highlight for a lot of RCR listeners would be RFK Jr. being picked for running the Department of Health and Human Services, which really was a promise that Trump made. You know, it was part of his coalition to say, vote for me and I'm going to put RFK in charge of making America healthy again. And it's just, people are shocked and surprised that a politician might actually be following through on his promises.
Yeah, and he's been put in charge of the big health-related departments. He's been tasked with bringing them back to the reputation of the highest standards of scientific accuracy or scientific basis. He's been tasked with getting the conflicts of interests out of these departments as well. So there's a lot of people like Dr. Fauci and these other people, if they haven't worked for the pharmaceutical companies, they have financial interests in the pharmaceutical companies. There's a lot of people who have who own patents of vaccines. So they have direct financial interests in the vaccine rollout. And so that's really problematic when you've got people in charge of making these big decisions, big public health decisions around the rollout of vaccines, public funding for vaccines, that they stand to benefit financially from it. So he's been tasked with reducing that corruption and fixing that, and I think that's good. And the other thing is that the food supply, getting a lot of, I mean, he did there's a nice little clip of him I saw on social media where he's promising to get this chemical. He does like about 10 minutes telling you about this one chemical, red, yellow dye number 5 or something or other, and how it's got all these poisonous characteristics. and the history and why it's included in the food and why many other countries have banned it and why the US hasn't banned it. And then at the end, he says, I could have did this same video for 30 other similar products. I'm not sure 30 is the right number, but a lot of other similar products. And it really makes you think there's a lot of products that are in the American food supply because of lobbying and various concessions that are unhealthy and are basically poisoning their food supply. So I think it's a really good thing he's in there and he's going to try and make America healthy again.
Yeah, definitely looking forward to that. Another top pick, I think, for RCR listeners will be Tulsi Gabbard at Department of National Intelligence.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember what half of these American departments do. I think Elon Musk pointed out that there were over 400 of these government departments. You think New Zealand has too many government departments. Imagine having over 400 of them. And by the way, speaking of Elon Musk, Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy for the Department of Government Efficiency, DOGE. I'm very much looking forward to that. They've been given 18 months. Very interesting. They've been given a deadline. America's 250th birthday, which will be in, I believe, July next year, 2020, or it'll be the year after, 2026. And they are going to be putting basically, recommendations for how to actually stop the American government from going bankrupt, becoming insolvent, which is interesting. It's an issue that I kind of started talking about and looking into and hearing a lot of libertarian figures talk about, 10, 15 years ago, basically saying, the United States is broke. It will be fascinating, absolutely fascinating to see if they can actually fix that, because it turns out that most of the spending, most of the reason the government is broke is that they're spending it on salaries, basically. Twitter had the same problem, and Elon Musk fired 80% of the staff, reduced 80% of the expenditure, and the product got better. And so if he does that to the American government, he could reduce the expenditure of the American government by 80% and increase its output. I mean, that's certainly possible. And that would revolutionize the world.
This is one of the things I'm most excited about. One of the appointments I'm most excited about is Musk and Ramaswamy, because it's not just about the debt. It's about fundamentally restructuring the way government works. So Steve Bannon has talked about the deconstruction of the administrative state. And I think that's what is being tasked with here. So the big government arguably started with the FDR's reforms around sort of as part of the sort of New Deal type thing. And that created this, that was the start of the system of the rule by experts, of technocracy, of these large bureaucracies with large experts were micromanaging various aspects of the nation and its laws. And I think that the public's trust and willingness to tolerate technocracy is sort of coming to an end, because the experts have basically disgraced themselves. And these bureaucracies have become so powerful that they're rivaling the power, and in many cases, usurping the power of the elected members. So it's so technocracy has become a threat to democracy. And there's a need to rethink, I think, how government, including the elected and unelected parts, the bureaucracy, how that works in the 21st century to redress the balance, the power imbalance between the people's representatives and the unelected bureaucrats. And then just to go back to Tulsi Gabbard, the great thing about this is a woman who was slimed by the intelligence community and other people as being like a puppet of Assad or something ridiculous. And now she's in charge of them. So that's great.
Yeah, sorry, I did skip over Tulsi Gabbard quite quickly because I kind of forgot the point I was going to make, but I just remembered it when you said she was slimed. There was someone in in that agency that she's running over now, somebody put her on the TSA special.
She's on the terrorist watch list.
Terrorist watch list. So she had to go through extra security at the airport. Every time she went to the airport, she'd be pulled aside and given extra 45 minutes of screening and being asked questions and going through all of her stuff and, pat downs and all these kinds of invasive searches. Somebody in that department did that to her, and she is going to be in charge of it. And she's going to find out who did that to her and who did that to at least dozens of other Americans who are conservative or libertarian, anybody who offered any kind of resistance to the woke agenda, potentially ended up on that watch list. And the people behind it are now going to have to deal with Tulsi Gabbard. And I hopefully she's not nice to them. I really hope she comes out for vengeance, because those people deserve the absolute worst that she can throw at them. Hopefully she puts them on the watch list. I think that's what should happen.
Yeah. the government watch list. We should make a watch list of the people who put us on watch lists.
And there are plenty of other picks to go through, but I think those are the highlights for now. And we're basically out of time here. I'm going to have to wrap up the show soon. So thank you very much for joining me, William. And it's a pleasure to have you back on. And I think we had a really great chat.
Thanks, Dewey.
And to all of your listeners, please let us know your thoughts. And we will be right back after this break.
Thanks for tuning in to RCR Reality Check Radio. Do you like what you're listening to? Or dislike what you're listening to. Either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057. That's 2057. Or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We'd love to hear from you. So connect with us today.